hammer.
I'm seeking representation.
The jaded lawyer with no respect for the law.
Innocent people can't afford me.
The truth stays with us.
Would you accept a client if you were constantly thinking, I don't want this person to touch me?
I have a case.
There's nothing to prove he did anything.
In this country,
you do not speak. Your job is just to sit there and look innocent.
Do you have any other questions for me, counselor?
I had a job in a defense plant. I could have taken a deferment.
Sir, I know the law, and I know my son is protected by those laws. They're framed in our Constitution.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back. I'm Dan Simrell, here with attorney Peter Paul Olszewski, former district attorney of Luzerne County and former county judge. And we are talking with Peter about some absolutely fascinating and devastating cases that he handled while he was district attorney. And this case, I don't know all the details, and that's why we're here. This case, when I heard a little bit about it, really shook me. And always when there are these violent cases that involve young children, it shakes me. As a father, it shakes me, and I think it shakes people in general, because these kids are so innocent. So all I know is that it involves a three-year-old, and maybe you can start there and paint a picture for us.
Sure. The story really begins on September the 18th, 1981. When a mother by the name of Roberta Culbertson brings her three-year-old son, Ben Culbertson, into the emergency room at the Wilkes-Barre General Hospital. Ben was unconscious, and he was cyanotic, meaning that his lips, his fingers, his extremities, his toes were bluish purple, indicating a lack or a deprivation of oxygen. The emergency physician at the time, Dr. John Corchi, recognized these symptoms as being absolute emergent. He immediately had a CAT scan done of the boy's head. And unfortunately, the CAT scan revealed that young Ben had a subdural hematoma. A subdural hematoma is a collection of blood from bursted blood vessels between your brain and the dura, which is the hard part of your skull. And what happens is that blood was putting pressure on the brain, and the entire brain inside of this young boy's head shifted to the left because of the pressure. So that shift when that showed up on the CAT scan, it showed that Jonathan had suffered a traumatic impact type injury to his head, resulting in that hematoma. So mom would then, of course, gave the hospital personnel a history, and she told them that 9 days earlier, Ben had fallen off his bed and struck his head on a dresser, the nearby dresser, that he was good for most of those 9 days, that he seemed to be unaffected by the fall, and that he felt fine. He was playing like usual. He was eating like usual. But then as we got to the 18th, so the injury she claimed happened, the fall happened on September the 9th, she then claimed that 9 days later, on September the 18th, she heard a noise in Ben's bedroom. She walked in, and Ben was unconscious on the bed. So she then immediately got called for a taxi. She didn't have a phone. She actually went to a neighbor's to use a phone to call for a taxi, and had the taxi take her and Ben to the Wilkes-Barre General Hospital. They were living in the city of Wilkes-Barre.
So the physician in the ER, or the nurse, whoever is doing this intake and gathering this information, I mean, if I was there, I would say, okay, this is plausible, right? This is plausible. But then the doctor said something different, didn't he?
Well, what's interesting that happened is once the CAT scan showed the hematoma, it's a catastrophic injury because the pressure is building in Jonathan's brain, and the only medical response is what's called a craniotomy, which is where a neurosurgeon would drill holes in the boy's skull to try to extract the blood clot, the hematoma,
right,
to relieve the pressure on the brain. And there was a neurosurgeon, from the Wyoming Valley, Dr. Sam Mackle, and he did just that. He did that surgery immediately that night of September the 18th. And
they're rushing this along, obviously. This is a critical situation.
Everything is being done emergently.
Right.
When he came in cyanotic, that condition revealed that he was being deprived oxygen.
Right.
And
right.
His brain was being deprived oxygen. He was having difficulty breathing. The oxygen comes from breathing, his respirations, and that was a
right.
problem.
Right.
So in any event, they did the craniotomy, and unfortunately, it didn't help the situation, and Ben was pronounced dead that night at 9:10 p.m. He was declared brain dead.
Right.
The doctors talked to Roberta Culbertson, the child's mother, about an organ donation. That was the only thing left that could be done.
Any silver lining.
Done, right. Yeah. So when he expired, they immediately harvested his organs, and they were donated for good purpose, obviously.
When does this, in the mind of the ER staff, how do you get contacted?
This is 1981.
Yeah.
I was still in law school.
This
is 1981.
Wow.
In fact, I had just graduated from Penn State and was just starting law school when this happened. So this whole story that I told you isn't about the 90s. It's about 1981.
What happens in 1981? Does this case move forward?
Wilkes-Barre police detective, along with a Luzerne County detective, they interview mom to look into these circumstances. And during that interview, she said that she was home with Ben and Ben's brother, Casey, and that Casey woke her up. She was sleeping. Casey woke her up and said, "Hey, Mommy, Ben fell." And she ran into the bedroom, and she claimed that in a dresser drawer, a chest of drawers, the first top drawer was open, the bottom drawer was open, and that Ben was found head down, stuck between the dresser and the bed.
That's a little different than what she initially told.
She didn't tell the emergency right. department folks about that, right? Mm-hmm. So it kind of made it look like he was trying to climb up the dresser drawer with that
right.
bottom
like stepping
right. up, and that his head was face down and his legs were draped over the bed. The end of the bed.
Huh.
And
and I'm assuming if it's a good detective and a good policeman, they're also interviewing the ER staff. They're trying to cover their bases, make sure that the stories corroborate. Is that what should have happened?
It should have happened. I think it's hard for me to say right now exactly what they did, but
right.
I know that number one, unfortunately, they never interviewed mom's live-in boyfriend, who was the natural father of this boy.
Wow.
He was never interviewed. An autopsy was done 2 days later by Dr. George Hudock, who was a board-certified pathologist in the Luzerne County coroner at the time. And he determined, based upon his review of the emergency room medical records and his autopsy, that the cause of death was cardiorespiratory failure due to the cerebral hematoma and the edema, the swelling.
Right.
And that was the cause of death. He declined to give a certification on the manner of death because he didn't have enough information.
Right.
And certainly the manner of death, it certainly wasn't natural causes. It certainly wasn't suicide. But the two possible causes would be, and it certainly wasn't natural causes.
Right.
So you're left with, was it an accident or was it a homicide?
Right.
And he needed to rely upon investigative information that the detectives would supply him.
Wow. So this is heartbreaking. The parents, the mother, distraught, I'm sure.
There's no doubt. They, in addition to interviewing mom, they did interview the radiologist who reported the result of the CAT scan, and his name was Dr. Bora, and he told the detectives, and he also put in his radiology report of his interpretation of the CAT scan, that the subdural hematoma was acute. There's that no way, no how did it happen 9 days earlier, and it had to happen within 24 to 36 hours of the CAT scan being taken.
Wow. Who missed that fact? I mean, that's pretty glaring, right? That is...
It's certainly overwhelming evidence that there is something missing or inconsistent with mom's history that she provided to the emergency room and with the interview information that she gave to the detectives.
So this is 1981, correct?
1981.
And please don't tell me that they just closed the book on this and accepted what Dr. Hudak had said and that they really didn't, or they didn't have an answer. How did it?
There was no evidence in the file. There was no investigative report or written document that showed that they confronted the child's mother with the inconsistency of her statement that Ben fell 9 days earlier versus the radiologist's interpretation of the CAT scan saying that, no, this injury happened 24 to 36 hours ago.
Right.
There was no confrontation of the mother about that.
Wow.
Additionally, what I did find in the record is that when they did interview some nurses who were in the emergency room when Ben was brought in, that one of the nurses made a statement that it appeared that Ben had a number of different bruises on his cheeks and on his face.
Wow.
That they were older, that they weren't black and blue, but they were fading. You know how black and blue turns like purplish, grayish.
Wow. So that information doesn't come out in an autopsy?
Apparently not. The autopsy report didn't reflect that. And typically, Dr. Hudak, and I probably was present for about 100 autopsies that Dr. Hudak did. He taught me everything I know about forensic science. And he would not have missed that.
Yeah.
So the nurse's statements, I think, are taken with a bit of salt, grain of salt.
Maybe she might have been editorializing that a little bit.
Could have been.
Yeah.
But the problem is the significant statement in the timing of the injury.
Correct.
So what happened is the file from the Wilkes-Barre City Police Department indicates that they were at an investigators were at an impasse by December 31st of 1981. And the case, while not closed, was no longer actively investigated.
So what happens with that kind of case?
It's an open case. It's not closed. No detective from the city of Wilkes-Barre or from Luzerne County is assigned to actively pursue it, but that if somebody came in with information,
it's still
or
there.
If detectives or law enforcement got collateral information somewhere that it was there and they could pursue it.
So this is a cold case. How long is this case? Does it sit?
Well, it came to my attention. It came to my attention in May of 1995. So 14 years later.
And where are you in your life at 1994?
I was finishing my first 4-year term as a district attorney. I was just on the heels of opening another cold case in Luzerne County, a double homicide of a mother and her young son that was 12 years old.
Wow.
We had just gone to a jury trial. I tried the case and had a jury verdict of two first-degree murder convictions.
Wow.
For a 12-year-old homicide case that had been closed.
How many cases are there out there, cold cases, at this time? Like, how do you say, well, out of this many cases, I'm going to pick this one? Or was there something that spoke to you about this particular case?
That's a great question. There is no inventory, so to speak, of cold cases. In this situation, what happened was Children and Youth Services of Luzerne County actually approached me that in the early 90s, the Geisinger Medical Center had hired a new pediatric physician who specialized in examining children and documenting physical or sexual abuse of children and treating them, Dr. Tom Novinger. And he became the head of pediatrics. Dr. Novinger began working very closely with Children and Youth on abuse cases throughout Luzerne County.
There was a sibling, right? Am I remembering that? There was a sibling. There's another child from this case 14 years earlier.
There was.
Is that part of the, or no?
No. Investigators later find out about that sibling. I'll tell you about in a minute. But in what had happened is Dr. Novinger became so good at helping children and youth with child abuse cases. They approached me to ask, is it possible for me to take a look at the file and see if Dr. Novinger can help with this case? There had been zero activity for 14 years.
Wow.
on the file.
Wow.
So what we did is we got the file. I reviewed both all the emergency room records, the autopsy record, the CAT scan, and those initial reports of the interview. And I said, well, I think it's worth taking a look at. So we had an initial meeting with Dr. Novinger. He agreed to take a look at the case for us. We provided him with all the reports, the medical reports, and ultimately had a meeting with him. And he immediately determined that there's a problem here.
Right.
He saw and immediately recognized the CAT scan results that said this was an acute hematoma and that mom's story was fiction, pure unadulterated fiction, that this happened nine days earlier.
Well, this is amazing to me that you look at a case file 14 years old, this doctor who's helping looks at this file, and that 14 years earlier, nobody catches on to this? Nobody sees this? I mean, this would be pretty glaring.
Well, it's unfortunate, and I have no explanation for how it was looked at or how it was pursued.
It was lazy investigating.
In 1981, but and of course, in 1995, I never heard of Ben Culbertson or his mother, Roberta Culbertson, at all. Was certainly unaware that something like that had even happened. Dr. Novinger was a little more specific for us that really helped us out. And in addition to saying that this injury unequivocally did not happen 9 days earlier, he said that the injury was so severe was so severe that it could not result from the boy falling a short distance onto a carpeted floor.
Huh.
Wow. He said, no way, no how could this child have suffered a subdural hematoma under those circumstances.
Right.
And then thirdly, he added that in his opinion, this was a severe non-accidental injury.
Wow.
So with that, that certainly provided me with more than ample reason to now pursue this all out.
I would say so. So what's your next step? What's the process for you?
So what we did is I put together a team, a special team of investigators, a number of a detective from my office designated him to work on this case exclusively full time. I talked to the chief of police of Wilkes-Barre City. He provided me with a city detective full time. Under these circumstances, though, we don't have a full and complete autopsy here. Mm. So I went out and contacted Dr. Michael Bodden. Michael Bodden at the time was the chief medical examiner for the New York State Police.
Wow.
He had been the chief medical examiner of New York City. He had been appointed to the Warren Commission, who investigated the assassination of John Kennedy and of Martin Luther King.
Wow.
And had been involved in performing autopsies and or re-autopsies of some of the biggest, most notorious homicides throughout, not only throughout the United States, but throughout the world.
Wow. So he knows his stuff.
Michael knows his stuff.
How did you get in contact with him?
I really just did a little reading and research, and found his name, and contacted him. And ultimately, Michael and I then, before my career as DA ended, we actually worked on four homicides together.
Wow.
Including a case where I was able to obtain a first degree murder conviction and a death penalty because of Michael. And to solve another unsolved homicide. So we became quite close professionally,
right,
and are to
right.
this day.
Right.
So I talked to Michael about the case, and he suggested that we attempt to exhume the child and to do some additional work to see if any additional evidence could be obtained.
Do you have to get permission from the parents to do this?
Two things. Number one, well, you need a court order allowing it. And in order to get a court order, one of the biggest factors for the court is the consent of a parent.
Mm.
So we needed to look at Roberta for that consent. But at the same time, of course, we're faced with a situation where now I'm being told that her story is false.
Right.
It's inconsistent with the physical evidence. And that could not have been the way this thing happened.
So in your DA mind, you're thinking she is probably not going to be cooperative. I mean, she probably thinks this is long behind her. This tragedy is way in the past. And now all of a sudden, here you come talking about exhuming her child.
First, we had to find out if Roberta was still alive.
Right, right. You have to find her.
We had to find Roberta, which we did. And this is the problem with old cases. And I learned this when I prosecuted Keith Snyder, that 12-year-old murder cold case. You read reports of interviews that were 14 years ago, and those people don't live at the same places they lived at.
Right.
They don't have the same phone numbers.
Right.
And at times, some of them are deceased. So that's one problem. The second problem is then finding these people and then attempting to refresh their recollection about an event that happened 14 years ago. So we had to find the emergency room physician, Dr. Querchi. We did.
Wow.
He was still in private practice in Wyoming, Pennsylvania. We found him, spoke to him, interviewed him at length.
Did he recall that specific? I mean, imagine
we showed
that
him,
does not happen every day.
Right, correct. And he did remember, and we showed him his emergency room records, which immediately had him recall
right.
the circumstances. We interviewed him. He was extremely helpful. He couldn't have been better for us to find the truth and what really happened. We also found the neurosurgeon who performed the craniotomy, and he was retired by that time. He was elderly, but he was also helpful, which certainly helped us. And then after we learned where Mom was, we interviewed her. And there was a lot of time put in into how that interview would go and how it would start.
And I imagine
how it would proceed, and there was concern that while we know it didn't happen, Ben's injury didn't occur the way she told us it happened. We didn't know, was she responsible? Was somebody else responsible? And
are you out of the gate when you find her and you meet with her? Do you just tip your hand to her right out of the gate and say, this is what we know, and now let's have a conversation about it?
That's a strategy that the investigators come up with before they actually approach her.
Absolutely.
And we did that. We learned that in those 14 years, Roberta Culbertson had a history with Children and Youth Services. And we learned that an individual by the name of William Luton. William Luton was her live-in boyfriend and was the father of Ben and was the father of two additional children that Roberta was the mother of.
In the span of that 14 years.
In the span
years.
Of that 14 years.
Okay.
We also learned, unfortunately, that William Luton had been investigated, prosecuted, and convicted of abuse of two of those children.
Who's investigating him? I'm assuming this is once Children and Youth, you know, they raise the flag and they say, hey, this needs to be investigated. Police officers, detectives from the county, from the CIFs, like what?
I think what happened was after Luton was convicted of some minor offenses. I believe it was a simple assault.
Okay.
After of Roberta's other two children, I think Children and Youth then put two and two together and thought that, again, the statement that Roberta gave not being correct, could Luton have been the person responsible for Ben's death? And if so, how?
So they're connecting the dots. They reach out to you.
Right.
And that's what started this process.
That's what started the process. And
so you find the mother. Who talks to her first? Who confronts her first? How does that go?
I had the two detectives that I assigned to this new investigation, Gary Sworn, he's retired from the Luzerne County District Attorney's Office, who had an absolute stellar career and stellar record in child abuse investigation, and Detective Norbert Swithers, another decorated detective from Wilkes-Barre City, an experienced homicide investigator and former member of their SWAT team. Those two guys were experienced detectives, and they knew how to do interviews. We had them approach Roberta, and they did that. And the first question, of course, number one, was she going to speak to them? I mean, there could be nothing done. They couldn't force her
right.
to speak. So the big question here is, would she speak? And number two, if she did, would she cooperate to the extent that she would change her tune? So what they did was they approached her, and they decided that the best way to go about it was to confront her delicately to confront her with the results of the CAT scan, with the opinion of the radiologist, and the opinions of Dr. Novinger.
So they come in right out of the gate saying, this is what we know, and it does not add up with what you told us.
Correct.
Where is the boyfriend in 1995?
He's still with mom.
Wow, he's still with her. So does he do a little jail time in the meantime, and they're back together?
I think he had a number of convictions, but I don't believe they resulted in jail time.
Wow.
In fact, he was working at a local country club as a golf course superintendent.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So when they approached Roberta, they also sensed, we hoped that her relationship with Luton had changed over the 14 years. And given the fact that he had been charged with and convicted of abusing her two other children,
right,
maybe it was time where she would come clean,
yeah,
and give us the true circumstances. And ultimately, that's exactly and precisely what happened.
Wow.
So what happened was, she actually then was interviewed by Detective Swern and Detective Swithers on July 7th of 1995.
Wow.
So I looked at it the beginning of May, and it took this time from May until July for us to
develop your strategy.
Get this together. July 7th, she agreed to the interview, and she
Does this come out in that interview? That right there?
This interview, first interview.
Which wow!
And that doesn't happen a lot. I mean, this was
no.
It was.
That was a gamble.
It was a gamble
that paid off.
But we had two experienced detectives who were going to do the interview. These guys knew how to talk to somebody, knew how to approach a victim, actually, and a potential defendant. In one circumstance or another, she had a lot of culpability, but
correct,
they knew how to approach her. Time passed. Time changed her circumstances with Luton, and they were able to demonstrate the right attitude,
right,
the right personality to get her to come forward.
Wow.
And during that interview, when confronted with the results of the CAT scan, she admitted that Ben didn't fall on September the 10th out of his bed.
Wow.
That was false and untrue. And she told them a story that Bill Luton was in fact her live-in boyfriend, and that on the night of September 17th, so that was the day before she took Ben to the emergency room.
Right.
Bill Luton woke her up, told her to get out of bed, and he said, that son of a bitch. And Roberta had no idea what Luton was doing or talking about. And he drug her into the kitchen, and on the middle of the kitchen floor, Ben was sitting there, and there was a mess of cereal, bowls, and spoons. And Luton was going crazy about how Ben had made this mess on the kitchen floor. And then what he did, according to Roberta, is he grabbed Ben by the arm and drug him on the floor from the kitchen into the living room. And he pointed, and he got Ben by the arms and held him up in front of him, in front of his stereo, and he pointed out that there was cereal on his stereo, on his prized stereo. He began shaking Ben and yelling at Ben about the stereo. And what happened then is he cried. He's cursing at Ben, holding him at how Ben put some milk and some cereal on his stereo, and then he threw him down to the floor, forcibly threw him down on his butt, and as he's cursing at him, and Roberta actually recalled that Ben grunted from the impact, the forceful impact on the floor. So then what happened is Roberta explained that she started arguing with Luton about what he was doing to Ben right there. It was cereal on the floor, and it's a stereo.
Right.
They got into a fight, into an argument, and Luton then drugged Ben back again by the arms on the floor, drug him back into the kitchen, and put him up in a chair, and told him to eat. He got the cereal that was on the floor and put the cereal on the table in front of Ben and forced Ben to eat the cereal that it was on the floor. And after, when Ben refused to do that, he picked Ben up again and was carrying him to Ben's bedroom. And Roberta followed him, and in a rage, Roberta said that Luton then held Ben like a sack of potatoes and threw him with both hands head first into the wall.
Oh. Wow.
Ben fell to the ground, and she specifically said in this interview, which was quite remarkable, she said that when Luton threw Ben into the wall, it was the left side of his head that hit the wall. Well, that's precisely where the hematoma was, on the left side of his skull.
That is unbelievably horrific. The two investigators come back, and you meet with them.
Well, they're not. The interview wasn't done. They continued. Then she continued talking.
She talked about more.
She continued talking, and she said that she picked Ben up and put Ben on the bed, and that she stayed with him that night into the next morning, and that on the Friday morning, the 18th. Ben got dizzy, he got sick, and he was vomiting, and that he began crying, and actually told Roberta that his head hurts. She put Ben, she continued to keep him in the bed. She left for a little bit, and she came back into the bedroom, and she heard him crying. And she came back into the bedroom, and she said that Ben grabbed his head, and he fell backwards. He was sitting on the bed. He fell backwards on the bed, and that his eyes and body started shaking. They were the exact words.
Oh, God.
He became catatonic, and he was his limbs were making uncontrolled movements.
The brain at that point.
Which is indicative of severe brain damage.
Oh my God! What a nightmare!
And at that point, Luton was home, and she
during the interview,
not during the interview, that he was home.
But he was
as when this was happening in real time.
Okay, right.
In real time, and that she said she was taking Ben to the hospital. He initially refused to allow her out to go, saying that Ben's a tough boy, he'll get better by himself. And when Ben didn't get better, she was able to convince Luton to allow her to go to the neighbors, to use a phone, call a taxi, and take Ben to the emergency room.
Wow. And all that critical time had passed.
All of that time had passed.
Oh.
They then interviewed Luton. Actually, they tried to interview Luton, and he declined.
I'm sure.
However, they did additional work, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, and they found that over these years, Luton had been abusing physically these other two children. And they were able to find additional people, neighbors, who confirmed and were witnesses to that abuse of those boys.
Oh, my gosh.
So Roberta then agreed. And the story of that abuse is quite appalling. It included that Roberta would tell them that at times Lewin would actually tie Ben to his bed, not allow him to move. He would make Ben sit in a corner on his, or kneel in a corner on his knees and not for hours at a time and not allow him to go to the bathroom or to eat. That there was a picnic, she recalled, going on, and Lewin actually tied Ben to a tree before the death. He would pick his kids up by the hair. He would pick his kids up by the ears and lift them off the ground.
Is all of this coming out in this first interview?
In this first
interview. Oh, my gosh.
Well, it's the first interview after 14 years.
Right.
She came 100% clean and gave all this detail in that very first interview, which just was quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And just what a great tribute to those two investigators.
Wow. So when do you find out how that interview went?
Well, they came back and they told me.
They must have been besides themselves.
Right. It was virtually it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
The information that came out. It confirmed the suspicions that everybody had. And she and Roberta did a consent and signed a consent to the exhumation. So we go back to Dr. Bottom with this information. And I prepared the petition for court. We had a judge sign our petition, allowing for the exhumation. Yeah. Dr. Bodden came in from New York City. Ben was buried at St. Mary's Cemetery on Main Avenue in Hanover Township. We went in and we exhumed the body.
Does the public know that this is going on, that you're working on this case? Not yet.
No.
So nobody knows this is happening.
Nobody knows.
Wow.
I think some people started to learn, of course, when the equipment was brought into the cemetery and we're doing what we're doing. And we took the boy to the Nesbitt Hospital in Kingston, and Dr. Bodden performed a second autopsy of Ben. We had Dr. Hudak was present, and we had Dr. Novinger from Geisinger. Present during the re-autopsy. There were some findings made that helped us. And as a result, then, if you recall, when Dr. Hudak did his initial autopsy, he did not determine a manner of death. As a result of this information from the investigators, and based upon the medical information, and the second autopsy, he now changed the manner of death from undetermined to homicide. And specifically, he indicated that Ben died of severe, non-accidental, intentionally inflicted injury that occurred not 9 days before, but within 24 to 36 hours before. And the manner of death was declared to be homicide.
Wow.
So based upon that information, I had what I needed to make an arrest. But it was still going to be a difficult case simply because, Dr. Quirci, this was something that happened so many years ago.
Right.
Our neurosurgeon was elderly at the time. A couple of the witnesses that had information about the abuse were unavailable. But at the end of the day, I made the arrest. I went to trial. I tried the case, and it was a week and a half long jury trial. The jury was out for a full day,
And at the end of the day, they came back finding Mr. Luton guilty of first-degree murder.
Wow. Wow. That is an incredible story.
You know, there are not many cases. In fact, I know no cases in northeastern Pennsylvania where prosecutors obtained a first-degree murder conviction after 14 years. And we were fortunate to do it in this case. And candidly, I was just as fortunate, or more than fortunate, more than this, to convict Keith Snyder after 12 years. Wow. So we were able to solve two cold cases, two murder cases, both involving a young boy and a mother of the young, one young boy.
I think there's a special way of thinking and looking at things from a different perspective. And I believe that your perspective is what was able to bring this case. You looked at it with a different set of eyes. And I think your intuition said, there's something not right here. And I, from what you told me, it seems like this jumped out at you pretty quickly.
It jumped out, but I have to tell you that the case wasn't so much one in the courtroom. I believe this case was won in all the preparation I did before I stepped one foot into the courtroom.
Right.
Roberta Culbertson, I had concerns about her ability to testify in front of a jury.
Right.
I was concerned about her ability to, in the face of William Luton looking at her a few feet away, to tell 12 men and women from the community about what right. the truth was.
Imagine her fear.
She had to admit to this jury that she lied to the emergency room personnel and to the initial investigators. I was concerned about Dr. Quirci's testimony. I was concerned about Dr. Mackel's testimony. And it was something that it was walking on coals throughout the trial.
Yeah.
And kind of like the investigation, it turned out better than I hoped. And
yeah, that's a testament to your tenacity and your instincts, I think.
So he was then sentenced. He was sentenced in 1996 to life in prison.
No chance for parole.
No chance for parole. And wow. I recently learned within the past year that Mr. Luton passed away in prison.
The monster that he is.
Yep.
Wow. I'm still flabbergasted by that, and I'm amazed by the story, and I am so happy that you found justice for that little boy.
I think it was great. I think it was justice for Ben Colton.
Yeah.
And it was a terrific outcome.
Right.
And I think I hope the case serves as a reminder to all future DAs and future assistant DAs that the fact that a case gets old, the fact that it wasn't immediately solved, isn't necessarily a dead end permanently. That,
correct.
That cases can be looked at, investigations can be continued with a successful result.
With a good attorney and a good DA. Well, thank you, Peter. This has been an amazing story, and I appreciate you sharing the details of this incredible case with us. And I'm Dan Simrell, and thank you, Peter Paul Olszewski, attorney, former district attorney, and former judge, for sharing this fascinating story. We'll be back again soon.